You are listening to episode 01 of season 9 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is the GNU World Order. This show is a technology show concerning GNU, Linux, BSD, Solaris, sometimes, whenever I can, and other techie and geeky things. My name is Klaatu, I'm your friendly host. Today we're going to be talking about parsing command lines, switches, and flags in bash scripts, how to do that. We'll be talking about bash arrays, and we'll be talking about non-DAW, that is, non-DAW, digital audio workstation, and we'll probably be talking a little bit about conduct and advertising and topics such as these. So stay tuned, let's get started right now. Episode, I kind of lied. I said that in this episode we would talk about some topics that I've decided, again, it's the beginning of the season, I want to try to get more technology into the early episodes and less just like random talking, so we'll trudge ahead right now with techie tutorials and stuff like that, and maybe next episode I'll talk about some of my more philosophical musings about terminology and things like this. That doesn't change the fact that I do want to talk a little bit about like advertising and stuff like that on some projects that have kind of made themselves apparent to me, but we'll get to that anyway. So for now, let's just concentrate on the good stuff, which would normally be listener feedback. I don't have a whole lot of listener feedback because I'm recording this episode a little bit in advance, sort of, so I'm a little bit at a disadvantage. I've gotten a little bit of listener feedback, but I feel that there's probably more coming in. But one of the listener feedbacks that was most important was one from Ken Fallon, who sent me a big, long terminal dump file of him kind of working his way through the UDEV tutorial, which he says, by the way, he enjoyed very much. And so he sends me this email, and it says, like, show notes for the UDEV tutorial or whatever, and I looked at it and I realized that he was correct. It's a process that deserves a written tutorial as well as the audio tutorial. So I went back, I made show notes. It's got everything you need to repeat what I told you in the episode through audio only. Now you'll have it written down. So that's I linked to it in the show notes for the previous episode. Post facto, it was like 2 or 3 days after the release, so if you go back and look at GNUWorldOrder.info, look at the entry for that show, you'll see where the links are. You'll see that the UDEV tutorial is now a link to another page with that UDEV tutorial. It's straightedgelinux.com/how-to/udev.html. So that's your ticket to a lot more information about UDEV and backing up with UDEV and stuff like that. So check that out. That's probably the most notable listener feedback I got because it reminded me, hey, when you do complicated tutorials like that, it really helps to have some written stuff down. And frankly, it's not just for you guys, my dear listeners, that's helpful. There have been countless times where I have either gone to do an internet search for some topic and realized that the most useful return on that search was a link on my own pages or on my own sites, or I've just not had to go search because I knew that I had that information right over here on my, in my brain dump online. So there's a good reason. There are lots of good reasons to do written tutorials. So it exists now. I apologize for not having it sooner. And thank you, Ken Fallon, for sort of gently nudging me in that direction. Okay, next we're going to talk about bash parsing. This is a cool one, so let's get started on that. We're all Unix users here, so we all know what a normal Unix command looks like, yes? It's something like command space dash dash 1 space dash dash 2 space argument. And that would mean run some command with some option that says 1 and then some option that says 2 on some file or something, which is the argument. Simple enough, right? So if we're saying, rsync dash a space dash v space path to one file, or a folder rather, space path to some other folder, that would be the command, one option, two option, and then two arguments. And that's normal for Unix. That's a very normal kind of syntax and a very normal interaction. So it doesn't really, it doesn't look strange to us, and in fact we kind of expect that when we sit in front of a Unix, Linux type computer. So when you're writing your own shell scripts, it's sometimes really, really handy to use that same syntax, whether it's so that people know how to use your shell script, or whether it gives you better scripting options if you want to then use your shell script in another script, giving it that kind of interactionless interface where you can pass these options to your command without interrupting the process and asking the user for a prompt or some kind of guidance. It's a really, really good thing. I mean, it's a proven method that actually works. So this is something that is very nice to be able to use if you're doing your own shell scripts, and even for the simple ones. I mean, even if it's just something like converting images, maybe you have two different sizes of images that you, or two different output sizes that you might want to go to, and rather than writing two different shell scripts that will automatically convert all your images, you could have one shell script, and you could have an option that says either dash dash big or dash dash small, or dash dash web or dash dash phone, and that way you could run the shell script once, and depending on what flag you give it, that would change what size the image ends up being spat back out to you as. So very useful trick to know. And for my own shell scripting, sometime last year I came up with something called Sport, which I called Slackware Ports, and it was supposed to be sort of a re-implementation-ish of the BSD port system, based or geared toward the slackbuild.org site. It was something that I did because Slack Builds had recently changed the way that they put information into one of the files in such a way that I had to now cat both the readme and the .info file in order to see what else I needed to install, and that bugged me because I now had to do something twice, whereas before I had to do something once. So I was going to write a script that would simply cat two different files for me all on one screen, and that was going to be that. But once I did all of that and figured out all of the things that I had to figure out in order to make this very, very seamless, I realized that making it install the things that I was catting would be trivial. So I added that as a feature. So a bunch of other features came along, and eventually it's become the interface that I use for the Slack build tree. And so it's a lot like either BSD ports or Gentoo Emerge or something like that in kind of style and feel. And in the past, when I originally wrote it, the way that I knew to do any kind of iterative loop was a case statement. So you say, case foo in whatever, and then you tell it all the different possibilities. You can say, okay, if it says search, then perform this function. If it says install, then perform this function. If it says build, then do this function. Rsync, do this function, and so on. So that was working for me, but the problem with that is that you can only give one option that way. If you give two options, it doesn't know how to parse two of them. It can parse, it knows what the command is, and then it looks at the very next word or string, and it parses that, and then it looks at the next string and assumes that that's the argument. And if that's not the argument, well, it is now. So that wasn't super flexible. And I decided very recently that I should try to make it a little bit more flexible, just in the event that people do want to do two options, or maybe they want to do two arguments, or maybe they want to do three options and two arguments. So I figured making this doing this the right way would have a lot of benefits. So I had to investigate how to parse options in a shell script. And there are a couple of different ways. There are some hacks, and there are the right ways, and then there are lots of different other right ways. So one way is something, I think it's called get opts, or show opts, or something, or shift opts, I don't know, something like that. And it's complex, and I could never understand it, so I didn't learn it. The other one is the way that Pat Volkerding does it in install PKG, or maybe it's Slack PKG, or maybe it's both, I don't really remember. But it uses something called shift. So in order to understand shift, you first have to understand how Bash sees the stuff that you're typing into it. So let's say that we give Bash a command like foo dash e bar baz. Now you and I could look at that, and we probably see foo is the command, we see dash e is the option, and then bar and baz are probably the arguments. Technically speaking, we could be wrong. Foo could be the command, dash e could be the option, bar could be a second option given in a different format, and then baz could be the argument. Either way, that's kind of our brain looks at that, and that's what it sees. The computer, Bash, sees foo is at position 0, dash e is at position 1, bar is at position 2, baz is at position 3. That's what it sees. Now, by default, obviously, Bash is going to execute what is at position 0. Now, what is at position 1, 2, and 3? That's up to you to decide. You have to tell Bash what to do with that stuff. Okay. The problem, obviously, is if you're going for maximum flexibility, you could say, okay, Bash, at position 0 is your command. Well, you don't even have to say that. It knows that. At position 1 is an option. Position 2... Now you're stuck, right? You can't necessarily say it's an argument, because if someone gives another option, then suddenly it's not an argument, it's another option. And then you have to tell Bash to look at position 3 for the argument. But that's a moving target, obviously. I mean, if you've got more than one option, well, even with one option, one option, you still have to do like an if-then kind of statement, like if position number 1 is the one option that we use, then do this. If not, then it must be an argument, so do this other thing. But we want lots of options. So in this case, or in any case where you have more than one option, the problem is that you never know how many options a user is going to throw at you. Or for that matter, how many arguments, possibly. So you've got this position 1, you've got this position 2, and then you've got a position 3. In this example, how do you know where the options end and the arguments begin? Well, you could do some wonky, like, okay, we're going to do a backwards command, and it's going to be foo baz dash e bar, so the options actually come at the end of the command. And in a way, that probably would have been the smarter way to do some commands, but the syntax suddenly becomes, now you have to know, like, okay, how does this command work? Does this have the options before the arguments or after? I mean, heck, I still have a hard time remembering which order to put the symlinks when I'm making a symlink. Like, are you source target source? You know, it's hard enough, so we don't want to do that. Now, on the back end, we could take whatever the user has given us, and we could reverse the whole thing, and we could take a look at the last string, and if there's no dash in front of the, or at the end of that last string, because it's reversed, then it must be an argument. We could say something like that, but what if we want the user to be able to put in 2 arguments, or 3 arguments, or 8 arguments? Then that no longer works. Okay, so the point is that the right way to do it, all hacking aside, the right way to do it is with something called, or a right way to do it is with something called shift. And shift operates on those positional values, okay? And there's a great little sort of a, a demonstration script that I came up with. I've posted it online. I will put the link in the show notes for you. It's the show notes for this episode. Thank you, Ken Fallon. And the way that it works is that it shows you where everything is in these positional values. So I'll try to explain it, but quite probably it's going to be a lot clearer if you do it yourself. But the first thing that you'd have to do is throw bash into a while loop. And you want a while loop because a while loop never ends unless you tell it explicitly to end. So we want this because we want bash to absolutely have to analyze everything as much as it possibly can. We want bash to exhaust all possibilities before it moves on to the next position. So we're going to have bash analyze each positional value except 0. 0 it always knows is the command, so we can forget about that. But we want bash to look at number 1, at number 2, and number 3 in this example. And we want bash to know to figure out what is what. So the way that we do that is we do while square bracket true close square bracket semicolon do. That throws bash into an infinite while loop because true is always true. And then you throw bash into an if statement and you tell it if square bracket dollar sign or quote dollar sign 1 close quote equals quote 1, that's the word 1, 0 or O N E close quote dash O, that's the or quote dollar sign 1 close quote equals quote dash dash 0 O N E close quote space dash O quote dollar sign 1 close quote equals quote O close quote dash O or quote dollar sign 1 quote equals quote dash O close quote close square bracket semicolon then. So what we've just said there, we've given the user a lot of different options for one option, and the one option we're calling 1. So if we save this command as options.sh, for instance, we would the way that we could execute it is .options.sh --1 and then some argument. Well, we couldn't yet because it's not done, but that's what I'm getting at. So in addition to saying dash dash 1, we could also just write the word 1, or we could write the dash O, or we could just write O. So the user can put a lot of different things as they're if they're trying to say 1, this option 1 that's not going to do anything, but anyway, 1. So we're telling bash to get into this while loop and then look at the whatever's in position 1 and look at it and see if it matches any of these strings. Is it 1? Is it dash dash 1? Is it dash O? Or is it O? If so, we'll have it echo something. And we could have it echo, for instance, at position 1, dollar sign 1. And then echo at position 2, dollar sign 2. And then shift 1. That shift 1 is very important. Because what's going to happen is that if bash recognizes that in the first position the string matches to either 1, dash, dash, 1, O, or dash, O, then it's going to echo what's in each position, and then it's going to shift everything by 1, meaning that what was in position 1 when it started is now forgotten about, and the new position 1 is what used to be in position 2. Now it's in a while loop, so it has to iterate through, it has to loop again. It's matched one thing, but now it's still in the while loop. It can't exit that loop. It's caught. So we're going to do an else if, which in bash is just elif, elif. And then we'll say if the dollar sign 1 is equal to the word 2, so T-W-O. Or dash dash TW or dash T or just the letter T. So if whatever's in position 2, well, now it's 1 again, is equal to 2 or T or dash T, Then we'll again echo at position 1, $1, at position 2, $2, and then we'll shift 1. So if bash ever encounters anything that matches the string TWO, or T, or dash T, or whatever, then it will process it, it will echo some stuff for us, and it shifts everything by 1, meaning that the next value, if it was 3, well, now it's 1. Or it wouldn't ever be 3 in this scenario, it would be 2 and then 1, but you get my meaning. So it's basically, it looks it starts at 0, which is the command, it looks at position 1, it cycles through this while loop, through these if statements, checking for matches, and if any of the matches hit, it shifts everything by 1, so that it now has a new position 1. And since it's in a while loop, it goes back to the beginning, and it says, oh, here's something at position 1, I better analyze the heck out of it. And it analyzes it, and if it finds a match, then it shifts everything by 1. And so finally we end up, we exhaust all of our possible options, and we end up at our argument statement. And for that match, we want to use the else statement. Because the else is, okay, now if you've encountered anything that isn't a known option, then it must be an argument. So for the else statement, we would say else echo at position 1, $1, echo at position 2, $2, and then break. And break, unlike shift is, I think of shift as a kind of break, because it kind of says, hey, you've matched something, quick, change the whole world, and then move on with your life. Break just says ditch everything, just stop, leave. And that's what happens at break. So we say, if it's not an option, give us our positional values, and then break. Get out of the if statements, get out of the loop. And that's what happens. So then we can close our if statement with an fi, that's if spelled backwards, fi, and we can close our while loop with the word done, because at this point, if we're here, then it's done. And then we can do some other thing. We could do the rest of our script. In this case, we'll just echo position 1. We'll echo $1 again. And the reason I'm echoing everything is because when you run it, you would actually see exactly, you would see the shifting occur. So if we ran this script with a .options.sh --2-o argument, then when the script runs, it's going to encounter position 1, which is --2, and it's going to see that --2, and it will echo all of the information that it has at that time for you. So at position 1 is --2, at position 2 is -o, and then it shifts 1. So now that option is forgotten about. The new position 1 is the -o, but it's still in the while loop, so it looks at this -o, and it looks for a match. Obviously it finds a match. The first if statement matches, and so it echoes at position 1 is -o, that's where we are right now. Remember, that used to be position 2, but now it's position 1. And at position 2 is the word argument, because that used to be at position 3, and then it shifts everything by 1. So now what's in the 1 position? If you said argument, then you are catching on, because that's exactly what's in position 1 now. So what started at 3 is by now that we've processed both of our options, is the new number 1. And so it's going to scroll through, it's going to, you know, it's still looping, so it's going to go through our each if statement. It's not a --1, it's not a --2, so it must be an argument. So we echo at position 1, at position 2, and then we break, and then we echo position 1. And that's what the shell script demonstrates. And if you try that out, you'll see it, and I think it'll make everything very, very clear, because you get to see it in action. But if you don't, that's okay too. The point is that if you use shift, then you are allowing bash to look at the first position, analyze the heck out of it, and then move on with its life, except that when it moves on with its life, it finds, oh, there's a new number 1. I'd better analyze that. So it analyzes it. It catches whatever match you have assigned for it, and then it moves on with its life. But when it moves on with its life, it sees again that there's a new number one. So it analyzes that. It finds whatever it catches, and then it finally moves on with its life. And the rest of the script is up to you. So that's how you can parse Unix-like switches and options in a command line program written with Bash. It's really quite simple, I think you'll see. I mean, it's not really that difficult. All you have to do is know what kind of options you want to allow Bash to catch, and then what you want to happen within those options, and then shift everything. And it just keeps shifting it until it's out of places to shift stuff to. It's out of things to shift into new positions. And that's it. It's as easy as that. So, the thing just to remember is that your arguments are going to end up from position one on. So if you are doing some command where you need two arguments in order to complete the command, you know, like you need a foo and a bar, because foo is going to be diffed against bar, or foo's going to get copied over to bar, or it's going to be concatenated into bar, whatever, then even though foo started at position, you know, 3, and bar started at 4, by the time you're finished your argument processing, or your option processing, foo is now at 1, and bar is at 2. So kind of keep that in mind, but otherwise it's all pretty—it's pretty simple. You just keep shifting things over until you're out of options. It's easy. It's really, really easy. And that goes—I mean, it's the same for like if someone decides not to use any options at all. Because what happens is that on the first loop through that if statement, it doesn't find a match for any of those options. And so it reaches the else part of your if statement, at which point it breaks, at which point your argument is number one anyway, always has been, and life continues as if though, you know, nothing ever mattered. So, yeah, really, really easy. Very, very nice. Very slick. So try that out in some of your shell scripts. I think you'll like it. You can always look at my sport script as an example if you want. That's available on gatorius.org/Slackport, I think, or something like that. I have a link in the show notes. You can also look at any of the system utilities that Pat Volkerding wrote for Slackware. There's always fantastic Bash scripting examples there, and I've got show notes online as well. So you've got lots of ammo to figure this out with, so have fun. Did I say have fun? I meant have coffee. Yes, it is time for a coffee break, so go get yourself a nice, tall cup of hot coffee, consume it, enjoy it, and then we'll continue the show. Okay, I hope you enjoyed your coffee. Let's enjoy some more Bash. So this is somewhat related just because it was something that I was using while I was working on the latest iteration of Sport, which I should probably mention just in case someone really curious goes out and checks out the sources to Sport. It's in the dev branch. It's not in the master branch, so you won't see it if you actually go get Sport and look at it unless you switch over to the dev branch in the Git repository and look at that. So, just FYI. So anyway, the Sport issue that I had after a while, since I was working on it, I decided that now that I'm giving them all this freedom to pass as many options per command as they so please, it wouldn't be nice to give them the same kind of flexibility with the actual arguments. So if they want to Sport rsync install clean Emacs, well, Emacs is already installed, Flowblade, and then they decide after Flowblade they would also like to go ahead and do the same thing to OPH crack, then they should be able to do that. They shouldn't have to do sport in rsync install clean flowblade semicolon sport rsync install clean oph crack. So I wanted that ability to kind of have the whole, you know, apt-get kind of flexibility of, yes, you can install as many packages as you want, type that in, and then walk away. Okay, so the way that I had to do that was with bash arrays. And if we've done all of these option processing, once again, basically shifting, for all intents and purposes, you can think of it as just dropping the options. I mean, after you've shifted through all of them, they essentially no longer exist for you. You don't have to think about them anymore. They're no longer at positional values. So all I had to do, really, to make this work was to take everything that was left after all the options, which are now necessarily arguments, and stuff all those arguments into an array, and then cycle through the array and do a set number of things to each item in this array. I'm not going to go through all of that because that's getting way deeper into sport than we really need to, but I do just kind of want to mention, if you've never used a bash array, how to use them, because they can be handy sometimes. So an array, I mean, it's one variable that contains lots of different values, right? I mean, I don't know if that's the exact correct way to explain it. It might be completely technically different, but that's how I think of it. It's a variable name, and when you look at that variable, if you were to look at it all at once, you could see a bunch of things. So if you just literally type in, like, array equals paren space 1 space 2 space 3 space close paren, you've just created an array called array. And if you echo $array, you get one, the word one. That's kind of boring, and not exactly expected, right? Because I just told you that an array was one variable with lots of different contents. Well, the thing is that there's this thing, or this concept called an index. So the index of an array is the thing that kind of assigns positional values, sort of, to each thing that you've dumped into this array. So if you now, for instance, echo $ curly bracket array square bracket the number 1 close square bracket close curly bracket, then you see the word 2. So could you guess what would happen if we did that same thing with the number, or the non-number, 0? Yes, you would see the word 1. So 0, 1, and 2 we've got in our array. And I guess using number names in my array was a bad idea. Let's redo our array. So array equals paren space foo space bar space baz, close paren. Now if we echo $ curly bracket array square bracket 0 square bracket curly bracket, we should see foo, correct? And sure enough, if I hit return, we see foo, because that's at the 0th position of the array that is array. So if we do echo $ curly bracket array square bracket 2 close square bracket close curly bracket, then we see baz, and 1 of course would give us bar. So that's a bash array, and that's how to call those items back from an array. This can be handy if you are dealing with things that either logically go together or things that are like key and value pairs or whatever. Or let's see what else. Well, I guess that's it. I mean, just any group of information that you want to kind of keep together is pretty handy. That's what an array would be used for. The nice thing about arrays is that you can also kind of, or one nice feature within arrays is that you can process them almost like a list. and you can remove items from that array, which is something that I had to do for sport as well, because if I was processing each array item, then it might try to do, like it was trying to do two of the same functions against, like, each item in the list or something like that. So, because when it would loop around, it would attempt to continue processing the items that have already been processed in essence. So the way that you can remove an item from an array is with the unset command. So unset, for instance, unset, and then you can do array square bracket 1 square bracket. Now we've just removed bar, yes? So we can test that out, and we can say, okay, well, echo $ curly bracket array $ 1, or I mean square bracket 1, close square bracket, close curly bracket, and sure enough, we have nothing. Nothing gets returned. But if we echo 2 or 0, we get foo and baz. And that's what unset does. It just removes things from your little list or from the array specifically. So it's a handy thing to know about, and there are lots of different tricks. There are commands where you can get, well, not commands, but substitutions. For instance, like if you echo curly bracket array square bracket at symbol close square bracket close curly bracket, then you can get basically a list, the whole list of everything in the array, because the at, just like for the positional values in shift, at gives you everything that was given. And there are lots of other tricks. There's asterisk. You can get a number of how many items are in your array, things like that. I'm not going to go through all that because you could just look that up. It's not that interesting to hear about. But the one, I guess, thing that was really holding me up for a very long time, and maybe this was actually because the whole concept of arrays, for me, I learned in Python. So, for me, arrays were something that were, you know, Python and C++ and things like that. So finding out that I could even do them in Bash was kind of a revelation. But then getting used to this idea of when you're calling things back from the array, you have to surround the array, the name of your array, and the square brackets that is referencing the index position in curly braces. That's the thing that I kept forgetting. And it's something that I wanted to kind of really emphasize here, because I think if you are used to, or if you even see stuff online referencing arrays in other languages, you probably don't have that sort of weird thing that you have to do. One thing about Bash is that it needs to know where to escape certain things. So if you tell it, for instance, to echo $ array square bracket 1 square bracket, then it sees you as telling it to echo the default index position of array, which would be foo, and then the string square bracket 1 square bracket. So you would get foo square bracket 1 square bracket. And it's foo because foo would be the zeroth position of array. So when you echo array without any reference to any other index number, it's just going to give you the first thing that it sees, which is position 0. And then square bracket 1 square bracket. Literally, because it doesn't know that the square brackets are referring to an index value for array. So surround that in curly braces, then it understands what you're trying to tell it to do, and you get a very, very different return back. So remember that, because that took me way too long to figure out. I just could not figure out what I was doing wrong, and then I finally realized it was not interpreting the square brackets as I was interpreting the square brackets. So curly braces. That's about as much about Bash arrays that I actually know. Haven't really used them that much, but wanted to kind of mention them so that you knew that they existed, and that if you ever need to start playing around with them, go for it. They're not as hard as you might think. They're really cool. Now let's talk about truth in advertising. fairly recently I was looking for some free alternatives to music production applications on proprietary systems. Not for myself. Me, myself, I've got all the music production things that I need completely taken care of, very, very happy with them. But for some systems around the place that I work, I wanted to throw some alternatives on there so that people could have sound production software on the computers. And I mean, Audacity is all on everything, but I mean, those aren't really, those are not digital audio workstations, right? Audacity is, it's a trumped up multi-track recorder, and that's about it. And it, you know, people treat it, and I treat it like a digital audio workstation sometimes because it's just so easy and quick. Don't know that that's the best thing for every job, but I mean, it works, whatever. But it's certainly not the right job for music production or sound design and stuff like that. So, well, I mean, it can be, but I'm just trying to say it's not exactly the right thing. So I wanted a traditional digital audio workstation, and I wanted it to be free, and I wanted it to work on proprietary systems because that's what these computers were running. So I went over because I knew that a couple of projects were, you know, kind of were working towards that, you know, the proprietary systems as a target platform. So I went over to it and looked, and I mean, right there on the main page, right there, main page of the project website, screenshots of the application, looking great, the window decoration, not a Linux window decoration. It's very, very clearly from another system, from a proprietary system. And then it says, this application is compatible for Linux and this other proprietary system. And you click past a bunch of menus or screens that you're to go download the thing, donation requests, the whole nine yards. You get to this download place finally. There's the Linux downloads, and then at the very bottom of the screen, there's like the non-Linux download, and it's in beta. It's just in beta. It's not even working yet. And I looked at that. I looked at the front, you know, the main pages, the website with this proprietary system window decoration on the screenshot of the page advertising the project. And I just thought, well, how strange is that? I mean, that's really weird. Someone going to this site, seeing that, clicking through a bunch of screens to download the thing, and then finding out that the target platform that they came to the site for was not exactly where it needed to be yet anyway. That seems a little bit odd to me. I don't think it would seem that odd to me if it wasn't for the fact that a lot of other projects seem to do a fairly similar thing. And I've talked about this before, and I still think it's an issue, especially in the realms of, you know, where developers are not your actual primary target, or maybe they are, but you're fooling yourself because you're online, and if you have like an audio editor or a video editor or some, you know, creative tool like that, then the likelihood of someone happening across your site from a random internet search for, you know, free audio software or free video editing software or something like that, it's fairly great, or at least you should hope so. That's what you want. So people are going to go there. They're going to see the screenshots of their system, the system that they're running in your screenshots, and then they're going to go to try out your application, and it's not even, it's still in beta, or it's not ready yet, or when they install it, it breaks their system. The sound system of their computer, they have to reinstall, which, by the way, happened to me. Not from this audio application, different one. But yeah, very bad idea, I think. I don't think it's like morally wrong or anything. I just think it's a bad idea. I think it's a sort of false advertising. Again, not in a really horrible, like, we've tricked you kind of way. Just a way that doesn't really help anyone. It doesn't help the project, and it doesn't help the target audience. And I don't know, maybe in a way it does help, it does hurt a little bit, because I mean, people who have an impression that free software is too good to be true, or maybe it's a little bit thrown together, or or whatever. I mean, they go to these places that are promising them free this and free that, and then they click deeper down into the site, and it turns out, well, when we said that it was free and that it was working for your platform, we really meant that it wasn't quite ready for your platform yet, but hey, stick around and bug test it for us. You know, I mean, that's not going to happen. And I would even go so far as to say that if you say that it's free and it's available for their platform, and then they keep clicking down and it turns out that what you really meant was that in order for it to work on their platform, they have to turn into a computer scientist, which I'm using hyperbole here because a lot of people think that any Linux user is a computer scientist, and that's not true. But, I mean, it really, you have to know your audience. And a lot of the people looking for free audio software or free video editing software or free this or free that, they're not looking to have to go install the developer tools for their platform and possibly an X layer on their platform and maybe a compiler. Well, that was developer tools. You know, and all this other stuff so that when they're using the software, they're not even using it in their native environment. You know, that's not what they think you mean. And it's not fair that you are saying that and then relying on the, well, technically I'm right. I mean, it does technically work on your platform. I'm shocked that you would be surprised that it doesn't look like every other application on your platform because, I mean, sure, you had to compile it from source and run it on this weird other graphic server, but hey, it's working. Proof of concept, you know, that's not what they want. That's not what they think you mean. They don't know that that's what you mean. And it's, I think it's disingenuous to tell them that it's ready for their platform. Yeah, you've got to dumb yourself down a little bit because that's your target audience as people who do not want to develop your application or bug test your application or anything like that. They are truly consumers. And that's who you're talking to when you've got a consumer-oriented application online. That's my personal belief. I could be wrong. There's an argument against it. I understand this. But I really think that that's the case. Now, if we're talking about web servers or frameworks or things like that, okay, we could talk then, right? Because then your target audience may be the developers. You know, it might be the set of people who, when they get there, they will not be surprised that, okay, well, it's a beta project. Okay, it's going to require me to compile it from source because they don't have distribution of everything yet. That's not going to land the same way as all of these other things are going to land. And I don't think it's fair to the users to pretend like you don't understand the difference. Again, this is personal belief. I could be wrong. I don't want to harp on it too much, although I probably already have, but it's just something to be aware of. And saying, you know, if something is technically true, then yes, you're right. You are correct. You are not telling a lie, but try to understand that the computer world is a big scary place to a lot of people, and they don't understand that when they come to your site and you have screenshots of a platform right there on your main page and you advertise on your main page, hey, it works on this platform, to them that's all it means. That there's no they don't even know to ask the question of, okay, well, how far along is it? They assume that it works on their platform. Like, click the download link, drag it to their application folder, or click the little install wizard, and they're done, and they'll be up and running. That's what they need, that's what they want, and if that's your target audience, then you need to make it clear to them early on that that's not what they're going to get, in my opinion. And there are lots of projects that do that. It's not just audio project, this audio project that I was looking at. There's a lot of other ones. I mean, I'm talking a lot of other ones. Some of my favorite projects in the world do that. They have that thing that says, hey, it works on this platform. And you look into it and it's just like, well, yes, there are two people working on a port to that platform. They've been able to launch one application in that platform and it does appear to run without crashing for longer than 10 seconds. But does that deserve a marquee position on your front page? Think about it, won't you? phrasing of the show, this particular episode, is something called non-DAW. That is, non-digital audio workstation. This is apparently a much older project than I first realized. I thought it was completely brand new because I'd never heard of it before. It's been around, I guess, since 2007 or so. But this is a fascinating, fascinating project. Really, really kind of cool, actually. Something definitely worth checking out if you do a lot of, or if you want to do any amount of audio production. I don't know that it's... I don't know how to describe it. I mean, I do know how to describe it. I don't know how much to rave about it, because while I'm really excited about it, I don't know that it's so fully featured that it would necessarily, like, replace a DAW, a digital audio workstation. So, in other words, if you're used to, for instance, Ardour or Qtractor, which are both really good, fine digital audio workstations, like, really nice, then non-DAW might not fulfill all of your expectations, but on the other hand, it may be a breath of fresh air. So if you could think of, even while I was trying to categorize it for myself, I was like, okay, maybe this non-DAW is like Audacity, but in a DAW format. And then I kind of looked at some of the features that Audacity had that it lacked, and that didn't really fit the bill. And then saying that it's Qtractor, but more modular, or Ardour, but more modular, again, features are missing that doesn't quite work. So it's really kind of its own beast in a way, but it does look deceptively familiar. So non-DAW it considers itself a non-digital audio workstation because it's not monolithic. It is a modular digital audio workstation, meaning that one component is a timeline. So think Audacity, but without all the clicking around. It's really, you can almost think of it as a graphical interface to SOX or something. I mean, it's just, you press record and you press stop, and that's the timeline. It's not entirely true. You can split tracks, you can move tracks around a little bit, you can do some operations, but you can't, like, copy and paste, for instance. You can do some looping, but the looping logic continues to elude me. Maybe it's a very specific loop tool. But anyway, I mean, I know how to loop, it just doesn't seem to do what I think it should do. Point being, timeline. So that's for your recording and your playing back. You can do different takes, you know, take numbers, you can mute tracks, solo tracks, things like that. But there's no mixing functionality. For mixing, there's non-mixer. So you launch non-mixer, and then you can mix the tracks that are in timeline. But there's no session manager. Well, for that, to tie all this stuff together, you can go to the non-session manager. And then there's one other component that is just not... Oh, it's sequencer. MIDI sequencing. Non-sequencer. Launch that, and it'll sequence all your MIDI devices. So the question is, I guess, how does this all kind of talk to each other? Well, the way that it talks to each other is through Jack. And this is kind of brilliant. So Jack obviously exists. I mean, its big purpose in life is to tie all of these different inputs and outputs together on your Linux box. So it really is, it's a mixing desk, you know, it's a bunch of hardware, and Jack is the cables. And when you're using Jack with Ardour and with Qtractor and things like that, it gets kind of weird because there's so much that is embodied in Ardour, that stuff that should be piping through Jack doesn't get directly piped through Jack because it's already included in Ardour and Qtractor. So, if you're using a Dizzy plugin or an LV2 plugin or something, that doesn't appear in Jack. It's just all within the Qtractor monolith or the Ardour monolith. So you're using Jack, but you're not using Jack for everything. And it's kind of this, there's a disconnect, I think, between what you think Jack does and what you actually are using it for. And it in one way it's convenient, but in another way it's a little bit confusing. You know, it sets this precedence, Jack does, and then you launch your DAW and the precedence is kind of gone. It's like, never mind. All the connections that you had to do, yeah, never mind. That application will handle it for you. So, I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's a thing. It's something. And it's, yeah, believe me, it's quite nice, actually, that Qtractor manages all the Dizzy and the LV2 and the LADSPA plugins for me. I don't actually mind that. It's really, really kind of nice. In fact, in some ways, for ease of use, you'd think maybe it'd be nice if Linux would do that for me, no matter what. But that's not how it works, and there are arguments for and against it. And right now I'm against it, so I'm for Jack. And that's what Non does, is it uses Jack exactly for what Jack is supposed to be used for. So you launch Jack, and you got this big Jack connection window, and you can connect, for instance, your synthesizer, let's say Zen Add Sub FX, link that up to one of the tracks into your timeline. And then your timeline, you can link over to your mixer. And your mixer, you can link over to your system, or to maybe a meter bridge. And then your meter bridge to your system output. And that's exactly what Jack is supposed to do. I mean, I learned a lot of this audio stuff on hardware anyway, so that completely makes sense to me. It's very easy to think about. I can see the representation of cables going from one thing to another thing to another thing. I understand where the flow of the signal is happening. I can even decide, now, do I want this signal to go through the compressor first and then into my timeline? Or do I want to just record straight to my timeline and take my timeline out to my compressor and then my compressor out to Jack Capture or whatever? So there's all these different, you know, I mean, everything is truly, truly modular. It's exactly how things are in the real world, you know? I mean, you've got these different units, their effect boxes. They each have their own different, their inputs. You've got cables. You connect the outputs to one of the inputs and then the output of that to another input. And so on, and it works exactly how you wire it. And that's quite, quite nice. And for that reason, Non-DAW has really, really stood out for me. I mean, I'm really excited about it, actually. It's really, really nice. Now, you don't have to use Non-DAW to replicate that, obviously. You could use, I don't know, Super Looper and Zen Add Sub FX and Jack Capture and Calf Rack and, you know, all these different things. You could do that and you'd stay modular. You could just avoid the DAW. But I find that the non-DAW suite is kind of nice because it does have a lot of the, you know, it's got a standard interface of sorts for all of its different tools. So even though it's modular, it still feels like you're still using the same application. But then I don't know, because I guess because the mixer and the timeline in my mind are sort of always tied together anyway. Like those two things ought to be together, because in real life you don't have a timeline. You've got like an 8-track recorder or something, and you would be mixing that signal out to some other recording device, or maybe you're mixing before you hit your 8-track. I don't know how you wire it, but those two things should be kind of together. So maybe that's why I like non-mixer and non-timeline. But it really keeps it very modular. You could use other tools. Your studio kind of becomes centered around Jack, which really, if you think about it, makes more sense. Jack is the representation of how everything gets wired together. And so that should be the thing that you're really monitoring closely and that you control. And it really brings to light, I think, how great an application QJack Control is. I think a lot of us take it for granted, and a lot of us at first don't love it because none of us understand it at first. Granted, I think when I was using it, like to the degree that I was using it with non-DAW, because there's so much switching of cables, I really do wish there was like a grab onto the cable mechanism and pull it out and reattach it. I mean, having to hit Alt-C and Alt-D all the time to connect or disconnect, that does get a little bit tedious. Or at least give me just C and D so that I don't have to hunt for the Alt-C and the Alt-D key all the time. But that notwithstanding, it's a really nice little application. It's just, I mean, people get so excited about visual representations of cables and other audio applications. It's just really nice that we've got it in Jack, where we can just connect and disconnect all kinds of things. I wish everything was Jack-aware. Everything should be. It's an incredible system. And if you want to experience that for yourself, check out Non-DAW. I do highly recommend it. It's at non.tuxfamily.org. It's fun to play with. Here's a pro tip for you. Fire up non-DAW, or non-timeline, Zin add sub effects, maybe not Jack-Rack. Jack-Rack, annoyingly, I discovered, or I've started to notice, when you fire it up, it appends the, I guess maybe the process ID or something to the end of its name, so you can never save it as a Jack session, because the name of your Jack rack always changes. Very annoying. So I use Calf Rack, and I think there's another one that I was trying out, but Calf Rack for sure. That's it, really. I mean, that's all you need. You can make amazing sounds and record them with just that little small set of stuff. Effects, you've got a meter bridge. I use meter bridge, effects, you've got compressors, reverb, stuff like that. You've got a great synth, Zin add sub effects, amazing. And non-timeline to record everything. It's really, really cool, a lot of fun. Patching stuff with Jack, save your sessions. It's beautiful. It's amazing. It's modular. It's making music the Unix way. So, enjoy. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware. Any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Got your email. Sign my GPG key. Thanks.